Welcome back to the show. It's 32 minutes after the hour. Sky Jathani is my guest on our studio line. He's an author and a speaker, and I want to get him on the show as often as I can. So here he is. Sky, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be back with you.
Yeah, you got a great story about your name. Did I say it right? Is it Jathani or Jathani?
It's actually neither. It's more Jathani.
Jathani. Yeah.
Yeah, but just call me Sky.
Yeah. So you've great story about your name. Would you share?
Yeah, Sky is actually a nickname, and I didn't know it was a nickname until I was about 10 years old because I had a aunt who came to visit from India. My father's an immigrant from India. My mother's a native-born American, not Native American, but Anglo-Native American. My aunt came to visit me, and she gave me a bracelet, an identity bracelet that had the name Akash on it, A-K-A-S-H, which is a Hindi name. And I thought she was nuts. Like, this isn't my name. And I looked at my parents, and they're like, well, actually, that is your name. And I found out that my given legal name is Akash, which is a Hindi name, and translated, it means sky. So from the time I was born, I've been called Sky. I'm still called Sky. And then there's a whole story behind why that's my name, which is, it's kind of, I don't know how much you want me to get into family history. But
well, I find it very interesting, to be honest.
Yeah, well, so my father was previously married and had a son from his first marriage, and his first wife died tragically young of cancer when my older brother was just an infant. And so when my parents met and married, I came along. My brother and I are about 4 years apart in age. And my mom had legally adopted my older brother, who was from my dad's first marriage. And he obviously came with a Hindi name because his birth mother was Indian. My father's Indian. And so when I was born, my mom didn't want my older brother to feel odd in the family as the only kid with a Hindi name. So she gave me a Hindi name also, Akash, and the nickname Sky. So in a way, my name was a gift from my mother to her adopted son so that he would feel normal in the family. And that's my name. So in a way, my name is a gift to somebody else. And I think that I consider that kind of special and important.
Yeah. Was there any downside to being Sky? Was there some teasing growing up?
Of course. Yeah. I mean, kids are horrible.
Oh, I can imagine.
I have a son right now who's in middle school, and it's bringing back all kinds of memories about what that was like for me. Yeah, of course. I mean, when I was a kid, I just wanted to be Michael or David or John or something normal. But there was nothing normal about my family. I mean, I grew up in the late 70s and 80s. And to have an interracial family, even then, raised a lot of eyebrows in a lot of places. And it was normal to me, but yeah. But now I look back, and I'm grateful that my parents gave me a name where the URL would be available in future years. So they had some foresight.
There's always a happy ending there, isn't there?
Right.
Yeah. Well, I love your book, What's Wrong with Religion? 9 Things No One Told You About Faith. And I just love watching your videos. You're just this gift that keeps on giving.
Well, I'm glad you're engaging it. I hope it's helpful.
Yeah. Let's chat a little bit about why you're sick of church.
Yeah, why am I sick of church? Depends on the week, I think.
Well, a lot of people, you know, are voicing this complaint. And it's not just people on the fringe. It's people that have a deep desire to serve God, and they're devoted followers, and they're sick of church. Why?
Yeah, it's a good question. I want to reference someone else's book, not mine. There was a book came out a couple years ago called Church Refugees by Josh Packard. He's a sociologist, and he spent a lot of time going around the country with his team interviewing people who had dropped out of church. And after listening to them and interviewing them and doing lots of research and studies, one of the conclusions that he came to, which is sort of shocking and counterintuitive, was that it's the people who are most mature in their faith and most committed to Christ who are most likely to drop out of church. And as a pastor myself, my intuition was always, well, it's the wishy-washy people. It's the uncommitted ones. It's the ones who aren't sure about their faith who are dropping out. And that's just not necessarily the case. So when you go deeper and ask, why are the most committed people the ones to drop out? What they discover is that most churches are so focused on maintaining the institutional underpinnings of the church rather than actually helping people commune deeply with Christ, that those who have a deep communion with Christ no longer feel a need for the local church, and so they drop out of it, or they're tired of the way that the constant bombardment and the institutional agenda of the organization gets in the way of what they feel called to do for Christ and with him in the world. So I think that's a factor, a significant factor as to why people are tired of church, is because church has forgotten that its mission is really about connecting people with God rather than just connecting people with the institution of the church.
Yeah, you give a great illustration on cruise ships. And I thought that was a great image. Maybe you could share that with our listeners.
Yeah, you got to know a little bit of the history of passenger shipping to understand this. So back in the early and mid 20th century, we didn't have cruise ships. There were ocean liners.
Right.
And what made ocean liners different from cruise ships is a liner was primarily a form of transportation. It took people from point A to point B. Before commercial jets, that's how most people got between Europe and North America. They took a liner. And some of them were luxurious and things, but primarily they were there for transportation, point A to point B. That's why they're called liners, right? And for many centuries, that's what the church was. The church was a community in which we gathered and learned and grew, but its primary purpose was to connect us with God. And that's why most churches were relatively small, simple, non-elaborate. Most pastors spent most of the week out in the community ministering to people in their homes and hospitals and farms and factories. And they didn't spend all week long in a huge church building, and they were simple institutions. Well, the cruising industry came along because people weren't using liners anymore. They were flying across the North Atlantic, and cruise ships came along. And the difference between a cruise ship and an ocean liner is a cruise ship, number one, it moves in a circuit usually. You get on in Miami, for example, and you go to your islands and you come back to Miami.
Yeah.
And the other side—
that's where you park your car.
Right.
Yeah.
The other side is for when you go on a cruise, the primary destination is the ship itself.
Right.
The ports are fine and you do that, but you're primarily there for the entertainment on the ship and the food on the ship and all the games and fun on the ship. And that for me became a metaphor for what's happened in the church over the last generation or two, is we've stopped primarily thinking about the church as transportation, and we think of church as the destination. We even changed our language, and we stopped talking about non-Christians, and we start talking about the unchurched, which means the goal is primarily to connect people with the church and get them involved in the church and in its programs and in its volunteer system and contributing to the institution of the church. And that means the church has to get bigger and bigger and bigger to keep more and more people engaged within its umbrella of programs, just as cruise ships have gotten bigger and bigger and bigger. And now they have, you know, rock climbing walls and roller coasters and ice skating rinks and all this stuff to keep people engaged on the ship. And for me, that's kind of a negative vision of what the church has become, because it's lost its primarily utilitarian purpose, was connect people with God. And now we've created a system where churches can survive if people don't connect with God, but they can't survive if people don't put money in the plate and keep the operations of these churches going. And I think that's something that a lot of people are getting tired of, and they're looking for that genuine communion with God again, not just a constant, entertaining, engaging, programmatic church.
Mm-hmm. And Sky, as we start to grow these mega churches and more of them come up, doesn't each mega church kind of need a celebrity pastor?
Yeah, and that's a lot of what drives it. I remember years ago, I used to work for Christianity Today and their magazines as an editor and writer. And I was looking at a different magazine, I won't name it, from a different company, a Christian magazine, and they had their, you know, annual issue of the 100 biggest or fastest growing churches or whatever it is. And it was a centerfold, and you unfold the pages and you see this chart with all the churches on it. And there was a photograph for each church, but it wasn't a photograph of the building or even the church's logo. It's a photograph, a headshot of the senior pastor. And in a lot of contemporary American consumeristic Christianity, we have become celebrity followers. And that's true in the church as well, where it's less and less about the community of believers, and it's more and more and more about the person up front on the platform. And I think we've seen the weakness of that model, because when everything is predicated on one leader and that leader retires or leaves or has a catastrophic implosion, mm-hmm. it puts the entire ministry in jeopardy. And I just don't think that's what the New Testament model of the church is supposed to be.
And you really want to invite a friend to church and not have it be driven by a celebrity pastor. I mean, I think it's great that these pastors are great and have these great sermons and influences, but you want to build a community of believers that want to show up and study God's word, regardless of who's preaching, as long as they're preaching the truth.
Ultimately, beyond the celebrity preacher, any healthy church ultimately wants to grow disciples so that they can have a self-sustaining communion with God. And unfortunately, the way we do church in many parts of North America, we actually create systems that rely upon people remaining immature, because we want them dependent on Sunday morning. We want them dependent on our teaching. We want them dependent on our programming, because if they don't need those things anymore, they're not going to come and they're not going to pay for it. So that's the other danger of this, is when you become so enamored with a celebrity preacher and you rely on that person for all of your biblical instruction and guidance and teaching, it's actually leading to spiritual retardation rather than equipping people to grow on their own, to learn the scriptures on their own, to commune with God on their own. But that's what our systems have created, and it's the financial and economic model of a lot of these ministries.
Mm-hmm. I'm talking to Sky Jatani, his book, What's Wrong with Religion? And obviously, we can't escape religion. Everybody has it. Everyone feels it. What are some of the biggest problems that we're dealing with today, Sky?
Well, the title of that book is meant to have a double meaning, because you can take it as what's wrong with religion, like religion is wrong, and the other is kind of the shoulder shrugging, well, what's wrong with religion? It's fine.
Yeah.
Why is everyone uptight about it? So it's got that double meaning. And but at its core, for me, and I already mentioned sort of my diverse background, when I got around the world, even as a kid, and visited different places and relatives all over the world, and I saw Hinduism and I saw Islam and I saw different forms of Christianity, and that exposure helped me. And then I come back to like the Baptist church I grew up in here in the U.S. I'd come back into my church and realize, wait a minute, like a lot of what we're doing in this little Baptist church really isn't that different from what I'm seeing all these other religions do. Why is this different? Well, why should it be different? Because at its core, what all religions share in common is fear, meaning the world's a dangerous place, and in our fear, we want to try to gain control, and different religions give you different means of trying to gain control over the world, whether it's offering prayers to the gods or sacrifices or incantations or dropping a virgin down the volcano, whatever crazy thing it is. And I saw that even in American evangelicalism, in which I was being raised, that this really isn't that different. But when I became a teenager and I started actually reading the New Testament and reading what Jesus taught, I realized what he said is fundamentally different than all these other expressions of religion, because he's not calling us to a system of control, and it's not predicated on fear. It's a totally different thing that sets you free from fear and free from control, so that you are then able to love, genuinely love God and your neighbor. So my problem with religion, I'm using air quotes, is that it keeps us locked in that cycle of fear and control. And frankly, a lot of American Christianity still does that. It's trying to make people afraid of the big bad things in the world or the big bad agenda out there. And if you just follow these rules, if you just say these prayers, if you just come to this ministry, if you just buy this book, it'll all be okay. And really, if that's what you're saying, it's no different than any other world religion out there. Mm. We've got to get back to the message of Jesus, which was fundamentally different and fundamentally liberating.
Solid, really solid stuff, Sky. Let me take a break. And if you have a question for Sky, give us a call, 877-933-2484. We've got time for a call or two, 877-933-2484. We'll take a short break and be right back. It is 12 minutes till the top of the hour. Sky Jatani is my guest. He's written many, many books, and the one we're kind of chatting about right now is What's Wrong with Religion? 9 Things No One Told You About Faith. Sky, let me ask you this. Is there too much infighting going on in church today? Are we spending too much time infighting instead of trying to reach the lost?
Oh, man, that's kind of a broad question. I suppose it depends on what the infighting is, and I'm not kind of a Pollyanna Christian who says that we need to just set aside all of our differences and all of our opinions. I mean, there are certain things that are important and need to be, like any family, you're going to have differences and squabbles and those things. Rather than brushing them under the rug, they need to be dealt with in a mature, healthy, godly, loving, respectful way. So in that regard, no, I don't think there's too much squabbling. Now, the question is, what are we squabbling about?
Yeah.
And that might be the problem. We may well have conflicts over things that are just not worthy of the energy that we give to them. And it is a distraction from a broader calling to engage our world and love our world and bless it and reach it. So I think it comes down to the specific cases that you want to talk about. And obviously anything that I feel strongly about is well worth talking about. And anything I don't care about is a waste of time. So we all have those biases, don't we?
Yeah, we do. Let's talk a little bit about why people are maybe just not reading the Bible. We've got access to Bibles like crazy.
Yeah, that's a good question. I saw a study a while ago that said the average, again, this is an average, the average American household has 10 Bibles. So to those who think that the only reason people don't read their Bibles is because they don't have access, it's kind of absurd. And now, of course, with digital technology, the internet, smartphones, anybody can read the Bible in any language, anytime, anywhere. So unlike some parts of the world where access is still a problem, any English-speaking part of the world is not among it, right? We have plenty of access. I think the problem and the reason people don't engage the Bible is because they don't really see how it's important. There's been efforts for decades to get people to read their Bible more and give them resources to do it, tools, Bible studies, whatever. So one side says it's a problem with access. We know that's not the problem. Others say it's a problem of knowledge or capacity. Like, I don't know how to read my Bible. And I don't buy that either, because we have created more resources to learn the Bible more accessibly than ever before in history. And yet the statistics show that every year, pretty much, the biblical literacy of people, including those within the church, is going further and further down. So I think the real problem is we have not convinced people that reading the Bible and understanding it is actually critical to their life and faith. They don't think it's necessary. So here's an example, like a silly one, but chances are you're wearing a shirt right now, I assume. You probably don't know where that shirt was manufactured.
I don't.
Yeah, because I don't either. Most of us go into a store and we see a shirt and we buy it because we like the look of it, we like the price, and we think it, you know, it's trendy or stylish. None of us think about what's the story behind that shirt. Where did it come from? Were the people paid fairly? Was it manufactured in my country or community or elsewhere? Those are questions we just don't care about, because all we care about as consumers is, how does it relate to me? How does it help me right now? And I think that's exactly why we don't engage the Bible. What people want is, give me a verse right now that helps me with my immediate need. Put it on a coffee cup, put it on a poster, put it on a tweet, put it on a meme, and that's not a Bible engagement I need. Just give me that boost I need right now. The reality is, most of the Bible is backstory. Most of it is stuff that happened to people thousands of years ago in another part of the world, in a different culture. And a lot of contemporary Christians go, well, why do I need to know what happened to Israel 5,000 years ago in a desert? And they don't see how that relates to what's going on with them right now. And that's a problem, because if you don't know the backstory for the Bible, if you don't understand the backstory of Israel, then you don't understand the meaning of Jesus being the Messiah of Israel. And if you don't understand the meaning of Jesus as the Messiah of Israel, then you don't have a grounding for even understanding the gospel. So I think we've just kind of pulled out these quotes here and there and these little verses here and there that make us feel better. It's kind of sentimental and it's therapeutic. But actual understanding of the Bible, we think, doesn't matter. It's no different than needing to know where my shirt was made. It's just irrelevant. It happened a long time ago. And no matter how much access you give people to that information, they're not going to engage it, because they don't care and they don't see why it's relevant.
Yeah, Scott, you make me think. So I'd like to invite a caller onto the show. Terry is calling from Maple Grove. Hello, Terry.
Hi.
You have a question or comment for Sky?
I do. First of all, Bill, I just wanted to say you're doing a great job in this time frame that you have now, and I love listening to you.
Thank
I'm always
you.
On the drive home.
Thank you.
I'm
Keep
listening.
It up. Yeah.
I want to say also, Sky, I love everything that you're saying. I've been a church goer for, 30 years. And so I fit into that category that you were talking about earlier about the people that I love my church. I love the local church. I want to be an advocate for that. But I totally agree that we've gotten away from teaching Jesus and teaching people how to feed on the gospel. And so I loved what you were saying of why people are leaving, because they want that in their life. And I think another component of that, and from my personal life, is that I think we get tired, because to keep the church going means I need to do all these things. And yeah. I can't keep volunteering. I can't keeping the VBSs going and the Sunday school going and the church leadership. I can't be on all those committees forever and ever and ever. Because you're dealing with your own life, and you need God in your own life, and it takes time and it takes effort to, that sanctification process is a time-consuming thing as well. And so I think sometimes those of us who have been doing it for a long time, it's like, I'm tired. I don't really care if we have a VBS. I don't know if I can say that. That's really bad. But of course I do, and I know that there's reasons for those ministries, but I think sometimes people get tired of serving in that way when the depth isn't there.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Terry. Don't I have smart listeners, Sky?
You do, absolutely. And I was going to say, what she shared, I've heard hundreds of times from people around the country. Again, very committed, faithful servants who, after decades, they take a step back and ask the question, what am I really doing? And how is this really helping? And why are we doing this again? And here's something to keep in mind. In the English language, we use the word church four ways. First, we can mean a building. Second, we can mean an event, like I'm going to church on Sunday morning. We can mean an organization. That's the 501c3 nonprofit with the programs and the staffs and the budgets. And fourth, we can mean a community, which would be the women and men and children who have been redeemed by Jesus, filled with His Holy Spirit, and are living in communion with God and one another. Now, according to the New Testament definition of church, it's the fourth one, right? It's that community of God's people that is the church. They didn't have church buildings in the first century. They didn't use the word church to just mean the gathering or the event. And they didn't have 501c3 organizations, and they didn't use the word ecclesia or church just to refer to the staff or leadership. The problem I think we have is we confuse those last two definitions. When you're serving on a committee, when you're running VBS, when you're writing a check and contributing it to the church, that's all the third definition, the organization piece. And that's not illegitimate. I think there's a really necessary place for that, insofar as that organization supports the fourth definition, which is the growth of the people in their communion with God and one another. But what a lot of people are realizing is the amount of institutional infrastructure necessary may be a lot less than they've been led to believe. And some people are put in the place of having to choose between, do I really want to give more and more of my energy, time, effort, emotional capacity to the 501c3 organization, or do I really want to be investing it in the community of God's people? And if there's a choice between serving on a committee in the church or serving in relationship with somebody who needs to grow in their faith, more people are opting for the latter. And church leaders look at that and go, oh my goodness, people are disengaging, they're not serving, they're not giving. But the question they should be asking is, are they still growing? And are they still serving the kingdom of God? And that's where we got to get our blinders off. Just because somebody isn't plugged into the 501c3 institutional framework doesn't mean they're not a contributing member of the body of Christ.
Mm-hmm. Sky, really a fascinating discussion we've had today. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I am going to send you 10 frozen pizzas as a way of saying thanks.
Thank you so much, Bill. I appreciate it.
No, I really, and I thank you for correcting me on how to pronounce your name. I will not make that mistake again. I was a little embarrassed. But thank you for being kind and gentle.
Oh, my goodness. If I had a dime for every time somebody couldn't pronounce Chitani, I'd be very wealthy. So you're in good company.
All right.
And I love being on your show. I hope to be on again. Thank you so much.
That wraps up our show. Have a great night, everyone. I'll see you tomorrow.